when we read poetry by folks who are incarcerated, or we engage, I mean, as a teacher, as an educator inside, you're spoiled by the amount of intellectual hunger and curiosity and overlooked genius that you are privileged to be in a classroom with or in a prison setting with.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So really excited to have Dr. Baz Dreisinger along today on this week's podcast. Dr. Baz Dreisinger is a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York. She's the author of the critically acclaimed book Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. She's founder of the John Jay's groundbreaking Prison to College Pipeline program, founder and executive director of Incarceration Nations Network, 2018 Global Fulbright Scholar and current Fulbright Scholar Specialist. And Baz speaks regularly about justice issues on international media and in a myriad of settings around the world. The film series she directed, Incarceration Nations, a global docuseries, had its world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival in June 2021. Really pleased to have you here today, Baz. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Hi, Baz. Even with this introduction to your impressive portfolio of achievements, we're not really doing the diversity of your career justice. There's a lovely paragraph in your book where you describe your multiplicity of identities. Can you talk us through your unconventional career pathway?
Sure. Yes, I wear a lot of hats, I guess is the polite way to put it. I'm a very strange being to many. but essentially, to me, it all makes sense, and to me, it's all highly relevant to like my fundamental mission in the world, which is around justice reimagining. So I have worked as a journalist, writing about culture, arts, and other things since I was in college. I actually supported myself through university by working for a local paper in Queens, New York, and so I've always kind of worked as a journalist and covered things like film, race and American culture, music. I am a music fanatic, specifically a Caribbean music fanatic, and also Afro beats music, South African music, music of the diaspora. So I've written a lot about that. In the process of doing that, I got a PhD in literature and African American studies from Columbia University here in New York. And my work, my dissertation, which became my first book, is about racial passing and the dynamics and boundaries of race in American culture. And it was very interdisciplinary. So I wrote about music in there. I wrote about film and arts and literature, of course, and history and cultural history. And I've spent a lot of time kind of moving between academia and pop culture and journalism, and worked in various mediums of journalism, including radio and film, and of course, print journalism. And ultimately, all of that led me to the prison system one way or another by a host of means, and so ended up at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, which is where I'm now based, and I am a professor there. I don't get to teach traditional courses that much because I launched the Prison to College Pipeline program at John Jay, and so this was more than a decade ago, and so I spent that the good bulk of the last decade developing the program, teaching in the program, and just generally being in prison, and kind of brought a lot of this together in launching Incarceration Nations Network and writing that book, which is really a book that is a lot of things at once. I mean, it's a history of prisons. It's a modern day travelogue. It's a sort of cultural analysis and philosophical analysis of how we got to prisons. And then it ended up launching, really, I like to say the book launched the network more than I did, because it just led to my having a network of people around the world. So fundamentally, what I really believe is that in order to impact change in the world in whatever capacity, you need to have your foot in a lot of places and a lot of worlds and coexist in a lot of spaces and be connected with people that operate in a lot of worlds. And so whether it's the pop culture world, the world of academia, the world of policymaking, the music industry, the film industry, I think we have to kind of bring all of these things together to impact change in the world and to really shift the culture and the conversation around things that matter.
It's so refreshing to hear that as well, Baz, I think, because I think what we often find, certainly within the British prison system, is that it's a bit of a silo. So people only really interact with other people that work in prisons, when actually there is, which the effect of that means that things are often a bit outdated in terms of development, certainly in terms of therapies and what happens to help people grow and heal and move on can be quite behind what happens in the rest of the world because of this closed shop sort of element, which makes it hard to have conversations, hard to create a broader network. And there's something, I think, from drawing on diverse knowledge where you get something that's greater than the sum of its parts, isn't there?
Definitely. And I think, too, I mean, when I started volunteering in prisons almost 20 years ago, it was very much about bringing everybody from all of these worlds into prison to teach. I was volunteering as in an educational capacity, and I was just bringing the people I know into that space. And really, to make great change in the world and to be innovative, as you say, then we need to have as broad a circle as we possibly can. And that's always been my philosophy. And I mean, it sort of developed naturally just because I'm also the kind of person, when I'm passionate about something, I'm full 100 in that thing. And so whether it's, you know, justice, innovation, or reggae music, I'm going to love them all very intensely, and I'm going to immerse myself in them and then try to bring them together, because they do come together.
Yeah, indeed. You don't like jazz. You didn't mention jazz in your...
I like jazz historically more than I like it, like, in the soul of my being, I must admit. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I'm not passionate about it in the way that I am about some other musics, hip-hop, R&B, reggae, kind of music of the diaspora more broadly. But plenty of respect to jazz always.
Good, that's okay then. So your book is beautifully written. It's full of these highly memorable phrases. One that comes to mind is about it's November in Norway, and it doesn't know whether it's last night or this morning, or I haven't quoted you correctly, but it's a beautifully written little phrase.
Thank you. So
within your book, which of course is called Incarceration Nations, you describe your trips to prisons in a number of very diverse countries, including Rwanda, Uganda, and Thailand. It seems too often in the US and Europe, we believe that we have a monopoly on being progressive and innovative. Why did you decide to take this trip?
Well, there were a host of reasons. I mean, at the time that I decided to travel around the world and go to prisons and, you know, eventually write about it, I was knee deep in founding the prison to college pipeline and in the mess that is the American carceral system. I mean, America is the world's largest incarcerator, and so on and so forth. And in many respects, as I get into in my book, we invented the modern prison, and then we, you know, with the assistance of good colonizers like the UK and other colonizers, foisted it upon the world by various means, both historically and today. And I've always been a person of the world, been interested in the world, and became just really fascinated and bothered by the fact that while we talked about prisons in the US, it didn't seem to be, you know, even halfway talked about in so much of the world. And so I wanted to go out and sort of address that. But I also wanted to turn the concept of prison on its head in some ways and really think about, from a fundamental kind of philosophical perspective, why do we do this? Why do we respond to harm with prison? What is the logic there? Sort of what is the history there? What is the logic there? And why? Overall, just why? And so And I felt that the best way to do that was to go outside of sort of the prison that I'd become, quote, accustomed to, although one is never accustomed to something which is as fundamentally bizarre to me as the idea of a warehouse for human beings or a factory for human beings. But you can just sort of become comfortable in that space and not see things as sort of bizarrely as you could if you're taken out of context. And so going to the world and seeing this same thing in a very different context, the hope was that it would provide revelations for me and thus hopefully for the reader as well. And so that's why I did what I did. And the other piece was that, as you mentioned, I was really interested in thinking about what could be done differently. So, and this shapes the work that I do always, which is that I don't only want to complain about what is. I want to think about what could be, and I want to see what is already that maybe we're not, you know, putting front and center. And so it became clear to me that the US and the English speaking world or the Western world, we're not the only innovators here. And there's a lot happening even in places where we least expect it. And so it also became about educating myself in what was possible by way of finding pockets of progress in places where I might not have expected it. I mean, I also found plenty of catastrophe in various places in the world, but it's also about thinking, where are the pockets of progress and what might we take away from them?
Thank you. In some ways, that's very similar to our motivation for starting this podcast, to try and eke out where the positive areas for growth may be, as well as the usual disasters. But it's difficult. It's quite difficult at times. So which country?
It's so important, though. I just have to say, like, it's so important to do that work and to do the work that you're doing, because people, you know, we talk a lot about change and we talk about ending mass incarceration and so on and so forth, but people can't really know what that means unless they see what it means and what strong programs look like and what alternative systems look like. And so it's very much about painting a picture of what good work looks like.
Yeah, indeed. So which country did you feel you learned most from?
I mean, I think I learned from all of them, certainly. And I think they're, you know, the places of inspiration, whether it's Rwanda and looking at the, you know, the truth and reconciliation process there, and the way that healing operates in ways that sometimes we don't imagine healing to operate. Whether it's thinking about sort of the role, you know, women and incarceration and how much from one end of the world to another, whether it's Thailand or the United States or Brazil, the situation looks so carbon copy from one country to the next. I mean, Norway, which is where the book ends, is one of those places that gets touted as this utopia for justice and for other things. And while there is no utopia and there is plenty to critique about Norway, there is a lot to learn about justice, broadly speaking, and about society. So I definitely still hold my visits to Norway and later to Finland, where I've also been, as very special in that there is a real sense of the kind of cooperative and the collective and the ways in which that impacts everything in society, whether it's the justice system, the healthcare system, and inspires me quite a bit in thinking about the power of the collective and what it looks like to build an egalitarian and as close to a really equal society as is possible. And that is what undergirds any strong system of justice, is lack of inequality. And it's really quite simple, you know, high crime equals high inequality. And so I definitely am deeply inspired by that region and its approach to creating a society that truly cares for its citizens and provides support for its citizens and creates conditions in which crime is least likely to occur. And that certainly remains with me always.
Yes, and you put that across very well in the book, I think. So you write that the birth, I mean, we're all concerned about the meaning of democracy these days. You write that the birth of democracy is bound up with the birth of prisons. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, in the history of prisons in the United States, the first two modern prisons were built in the United States in the 1820s. And they were built based on European ideas, British, French, sort of Enlightenment ideas about creating a more humane system of punishment, a more civilized, quote unquote, system of dealing with crime than, say, the guillotine or the stocks or, you know, other kind of flogging and other such things. There was also an interest, this is the age of reason, so quote unquote, the age of reason. And so there was a notion of being able to do things in a more scientific way. So the idea of a sentence, if you can warehouse people and create X amount of years for X amount of crime and then fix the problem, it really excited people according to their ideas of science and mathematical equations. And this was all the rage, the conversation. And the U.S., as a new democracy that's very eager to prove itself in the world and say, look, we can do things better and we're more civilized than our former colonizer and other parts of the world. So we're going to go, you know, full force and develop these ideas into reality. And so part of exerting our innovative nature as a democracy became showcasing our prisons. How we deal with crime is so much more civilized than how you're dealing with crime, other nations. And come look at Eastern State Penitentiary, one of the first two modern prisons, where there's running water here before there is in the White House. That's the level of investment the United States had in developing its prison system. And so, and I think that's still true. I think that is still part of us asserting our sort of abilities to create a just society and our ability to be the best in the world, the biggest and the best in the world, that we are still saying that the way we do prisons and our supermaxes and our ability to privatize prison industries and make money off all of this, these are all American innovations that then became practice in the world. So I think it all does to a great extent, if we take the monetary factor out of this, which is hard to do because it's also very much about money and capitalism, but it's also about cultural capital and about being the best and the biggest and you know, to have the best McDonald's prison system in the world.
So I found it quite interesting that you spoke about the science supporting the development of prisons, because I think it's now quite clear that prisons don't work. So I wonder what you think the science now shows in terms of rehabilitation and reform and enabling people to play a more meaningful contribution to society.
Well, it's great that you say that. You know, we all know that prisons don't work. Sadly, we might know that in this conversation, but the world's been duped, and people imagine that prisons do work, and that is the great tragedy. Because it's not about, you know, I mean, this conversation we're having around COVID and vaccines in terms of pay attention to the science, we've been ignoring science as a global society for quite some time. And in this case, the social science that shows us that not only do prisons not make us, they don't make us safe, they actually make us less safe, and that they produce crime and they ramp up inequality, which produces more crime. So even if we take the sort of humanitarian aspect out of it and the unkindness of prisons, just on a very basic level, they're not making us safer. And that is the alleged purpose of prison. Now, we know that there are actually other purposes, i.e. making money, i.e. Racial and social control of certain groups. But I think we are finally, and I'll be the optimist here, and this is in part because I feel like I'm surrounded in my work and in my mission in the world by people who are making a difference and a dent in the system. But I think we're finally reaching a place where folks are saying, okay, it's time to actually consider what does work. What does make us safer? What if we had systems like the open prisons in Scandinavia, for instance, which exist elsewhere in the world as well? And what if we didn't just warehouse people away, but allowed them to be integrated throughout this time where we were allegedly, quote, correcting them? What if we invested in communities and community justice centers and proper restorative justice programs? And what if we treated substance abuse radically differently than we treated and actually treated it as a health issue as opposed to a crime issue, right? So I think that when we start moving away into that, and it's happening already, but I think a large portion of the work is convincing the public that these things work better, and that if we're really, really about creating safer communities and peaceful societies, then we need to rethink prisons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess you probably have the same issues with the press that we have in the UK, where that seems to be the only answer that's offered up to in an attempt to solve crime, really.
Yes. I mean, I'll just say that we have that problem here, even among progressive circles. I mean, I think I often find it distressing that even in, you know, a horrible case that we're all outraged about, suddenly everybody is relieved when that person gets a lot of prison time. And it's the same people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, I'm an abolitionist, I don't believe in prison, but suddenly you believe in it when it suits your, you know, your sort of anger and need for revenge. Mm-hmm. And that's troubling to me. And it really represents how much work we have to do in getting people to radically rethink and undermine their comfort with this approach to harm.
There's a kind of law of unintended consequences comes in here, doesn't it? Because I was thinking of Martinson and his What Works drive, which had the unfortunate consequence of making prisons more punitive and less helpful, when in fact I think he was more of an abolitionist in himself.
Absolutely.
So Baz, one of the personal realisations you describe really powerfully in your book is a recognition that a victim's interests may not be best served by being dragged back to the past. Can you say a bit more about what you meant by this? I think you were kind of like really drawing on your own personal story as well within that.
Yeah, I think, I think one of the things that I learned most of all in my journeys, David, you were asking, you know, where did I learn from? And the time that I spent in Rwanda with young survivors of genocide was deeply, profoundly illuminating around our assumptions, and by our, I mean sort of the general public at large, our assumptions about the needs of victims, right? We assume generally, and that's what prison is a response to, we assume that people who've been harmed want revenge, and that revenge is going to give them a sense of justice. And that is selling people and selling survivors of harm very short. And in fact, what studies have shown us, and I in the book share some of my own personal experience of being generationally a descendant of Holocaust survivors, so generationally a descendant of genocide. I think we really need to rethink what these assumptions are, that in fact revenge doesn't bring us the healing that we deserve as survivors. That the idea of harming someone who has caused harm is fundamentally hypocritical, right? Just even from an objective philosophical standpoint, that it doesn't make us safer, that it doesn't produce the need for safety that survivors of great harm have a desire for. They want to feel safe. They want to know this won't happen again. Prison is not the path to those things. And I think there are other things that we can do, namely restorative justice methods that are shown to be time and again more successful at producing the things that survivors want, the healing that they want, the feeling of safety, the assurance that this won't happen again. Restorative justice time and again has been shown to bring us to that end in ways that prisons, which to me are revenge on a grand scale, don't.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we were talking previously about the science. The science seems to come down very heavily in favour of restorative justice as a way forward, doesn't it? Rather
it
than
definitely
punitive.
Yes, it definitely does. And I think that's so important, again, because usually whenever I do talks or engage with folks about the prison system, the first question is always, but what about the victim? And I say, yes, what about the victim? You know, this is not a system that actually considers the victim fully and considers the science about the victim's needs. And I don't mean to suggest that it's as simple as every survivor of harm wants the same thing. No, of course, that varies quite a bit. But the system only gives them one thing, and that is revenge in prison. And what would a system that actually offered them various things or various options look like? That is the system that I think we're all working toward.
Absolutely, because I think if you're kind of like tied up in vengeance and punishment and retaliation, in some way you're kind of like bound to the perpetrator in a way that doesn't offer any possibility for resolution, does it, for either party? Whereas actually restorative justice seems to hold what the person who's been harmed needs more in mind. You know, it involves an interaction that enables their needs to actually be central to the process rather than just being a byproduct of what happens.
Yes, indeed. And I think it doesn't, you know, our current system, and especially the legal system, when we think about, you know, the law and courts, the person who's been harmed has no voice. They're just a sort of a cog in the wheel of a system. And I've heard people time and again that I've either chatted with casually or interviewed about this, talk about how the traditional legal system was not fulfilling for them at all as a survivor. There was no opportunity to engage with the person who harmed them. There was no opportunity to have a voice really in the process. Your lawyer speaks for you. And there's so much wrong with that in terms of if we're really aiming to design a system that centers the needs of those who've been harmed in a real way.
Thank you. In your chapter on Jamaican prisons, you dwell a lot on music, and you write that it might not be a good thing for the arts to be so associated with prison because art can dazzle and blind us. What did you mean by this?
Well, I say this as an artist and as someone who engages in teaching art in prisons. I taught writing in the prison to college pipeline for a decade. I've, you know, done other workshops and write about that in the book as well. So I certainly believe in art. I love art. And I think that it is a lifeline for people on the inside who are caught in the system as a way of giving them agency and keeping them sane and reclaiming their own identities in a system designed to dehumanize. So it's certainly powerful in that respect. But the place where I ultimately reach when I think about these programs inside prisons is that when something is so rotten at its core and needs to be overhauled, in what ways do the programs we provide allow it to keep going and allow it to function, and instead of just sort of, as I put it, ripping off the Band-Aid and letting it bleed? Because I say this not by any means to denounce people doing this work on the inside. I still do it, so I'm complicit. But I think it's more about recognizing the ways in which when we do this, we are being complicit in a system that we know needs radical overhaul. And that is only a Band-Aid. And if we keep putting Band-Aids on something, it makes it easy for us to not address the gaping wound. And so there's an argument for ripping all the Band-Aids off, even if the Band-Aids are beautiful and even if the Band-Aids are keeping something alive. And so to me, an art, I think, is one of the most challenging Band-Aids to rip off, A, because it's keeping people alive in the here and the now, and B, because it's beautiful. And when we read poetry by folks who are incarcerated or we engage, I mean, as a teacher, as an educator inside, you're spoiled by the amount of intellectual hunger and curiosity and overlooked genius that you are privileged to be in a classroom with or in a prison setting with. So I just think I'm consistently reminding myself and others that by doing that, it's a mixed bag, and that in some ways we are allowing a system that we are deeply critical of to continue by engaging in these activities. And that is a paradox, and part of the paradox of doing, one of the many paradoxes, I think, of doing this work.
I can really identify with what you're saying, and certainly I read your book for the first time last year, and I suppose what it brought to mind for me was there are you know, quite a few places that are specialist treatment services. And what happens is those treatment services get wheeled out to impress foreign ministers of justice when they come to Britain, so they can see that, you know, this is the good work that can happen in a prison. But of course, the vast majority of people who are in prison don't receive, they're not in those services. They don't receive that level of engagement with treatment. I mean, is that your experience as well, David?
Pretty much so, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was fortunate in working in Grendon, which of course was a large treatment with a single focus. So we did get lots of visitors, but at least we weren't having to kind of illustrate that we did it in the small corner of the establishment.
Well, I think those kinds of prisons, like I've been to Grendon, and I've been to those kinds of prisons, the exceptional prison. Almost every country has a version of that, the one that they can tout to the authorities, whether it's, whether it's local press or, as you say, foreign dignitaries coming in. It's the one that makes you feel good about the system as a whole. And I think that's exactly the kind of paradox, because I'm glad there are Grendons. I'm glad there are, Bastøy's in Norway, but what about everything else? You know, so I'm not saying let's do away with those, but rather how do we simultaneously engage with those, but not be content with the exceptional prison or the exceptional program or some such thing?
I think that's right. But I think each of us as an individual needs to find some way, something to help us keep a grasp on reality. So mine was of walking towards the gate on our wing, which was one of those gates with bars, and talking to a man who was a lifer, getting to the gate, opening it with my key, carrying on talking to him, walking through, locking the gate, carrying on talking to him. And that's fixed. That's 20 years ago, and it's still there to remind me that I was in a very different, a very privileged position.
Mm-hmm. I think those are the rare moments when I actually, engage in a quote prison tour. You know, I avoid those like the plague, but every now and then you need to be reminded of this system, of what it, you know, because even as a college professor going in and out of prison teaching for a decade, you're in this brilliant classroom of wonderful students and you know what, you can't, and you hear, you're dealing with, you know, a lot of vicarious trauma, and you're hearing all the stories, and you're watching the parole denials and all of the other torturous things and students getting thrown in solitary confinement. But, you know, when you're in that blessed classroom, it can be easy to not have the image that you just described front and center. And so when I think about that, I think about going on a tour of Pentonville, for instance, which, with a friend who runs the educational programs there. And I just went to go with him and to talk to some people and, you know, meet some folks there and talk to them about education. And it was that welcome, brutal reminder of what this system is really about. And I think even those of us who are there on the regular need that brutal reminder, sort of to keep us fueled in the work.
Thank you. Can you tell us about the Incarceration Nations think tank that you founded, what it is, why it was set up, and what are some of the issues it's concerned with?
Sure. So Incarceration Nations Network, kind of, as I was mentioning earlier, came about a bit naturally as my book came out and as I was moving in the world. I had a Fulbright scholarship, so I was kind of moving about looking at education programs globally. I was also working both formally and informally to build versions of the prison to college pipeline in other countries, in South Africa, in Jamaica, other countries where I had developed, you know, close relationships and a life. And it just sort of naturally came to be that I was connecting people doing this work in various parts of the world who didn't know about each other. And I thought to myself, that should not be. We need a more formal network that brings together globally people doing this work for a whole host of reasons, whether it's best practices and being able to share doing this work and how to do it well, whether it's building global coalition in order to make the fight stronger. And so I decided to found that network. And so INN became this connective tissue for almost 120 organizations around the world doing a variety of work in prisons, whether it's education behind bars or other kinds of rehabilitative programming, whether it's reintegration programs, broad-reaching policy and advocacy work, legal reform and legal assistance work, and created this network. And so what we do is, we're cheerleaders for people's work in the world. And so we stage events and other kinds of attention-grabbing things to amplify the strong work that's being done. And we also learn from each other. We build off each other's practices and successes, engage with each other. And I think especially act as a kind of support system for organizations who are doing this work in parts of the world where it is just so deeply unpopular. I mean, here in the US, when I started doing work in prisons, it was deeply unpopular and unfundable significantly. It was very hard if you wanted to build an education program, say, in prison, to get funding for that. That has radically shifted, certainly, in the last, you know, maybe 8 years here through a whole host of mechanisms. I think, you know, I'm talking to you in the UK, and it's definitely grown in popularity as an issue and become more more fundable and more sellable to the public than it has been. But our partners operate in places where that is not the case, and people don't want to talk about prisons at all. And so how do we bring sort of, or how do we leverage the popularity and the broader cultural shift of, say, the UK, the US, and other countries where this has happened, in order to benefit not just us, but the world, and recognize that this is a global struggle, and that if we're going to truly abolish prisons and build a world without prisons, that we need to do it under global coalition. And so we use art quite a bit in order to achieve that end. So events that are appealing to a broad range, coming back to what we started with, the many hats that I wear, I bring that to the network. And so an INN event is not necessarily only going to be for policymakers or academics or NGOs. It's going to be for all the above, and for filmmakers and artists and the formerly incarcerated person who's, you know, wants to get involved in the movement and have a voice in the movement, and the person off the street who never thought about prisons before and needs to think about prisons, because we're not going to make change unless all of the folks are in the room. And so that undergirds our philosophy and how we approach everything that we do.
And it's a really rich website, actually, with lots of factual information on there, as well as lots of different links and agencies. How do people get involved with the network? What would you advise?
So the website definitely would be the place to start, and that's incarcerationnationsnetwork.org. And there's, as you say, it's chock full of information about prisons globally. You can learn about our partners. You can sign up for our mailing list. We're also on social media, Incarceration Nations, where we advertise all of our, and Facebook, Incarceration Nations on Instagram. On Facebook, we're Incarceration Nations Network. And we advertise events that we're doing all the time. We're just starting our in-person programming slowly in the U.S. and in various parts of Europe in the coming months. And you know, very much welcome people listening to follow us and attend our events, whether virtually or in person, and, you know, be part of our community.
And we'll post links within the show notes to the show as well. But you've recently been very involved in what's described on the INN website as a global docuseries, which premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in June. Can you tell us something about these films and how people can get to see them?
Yes, so we are... Ultimately, this was a lot of us had to do in our work pandemic pivots and rethink how we do things. And so we were planning a whole host of global gatherings and events that could not happen. And so ultimately, I used the time in order to direct a docuseries. I had been filming in countries around the world, mainly interviews with clients of our partners and other folks who have lived experience of incarceration all around the world, and had always planned to do something with it on some faraway day, and the pandemic became that faraway day. So I worked with an incredible creative agency who we partner with on a number of our initiatives, Chemistry Creative, and just started putting together this docuseries that tells the story of global mass incarceration entirely in the voices of those who've lived it. And it's really, I call it kind of living witnesses, that the people in these films give testimony of what they've lived. And each episode in the series has a different theme that pulls together across borders these different voices. So there's an episode about women, there's one about the war on drugs, there's an episode about reintegration or reentry, there's an episode about education, not incarceration, one on restorative justice. And again, all of these are in the voices of those impacted from all across the world. And we premiered at Tribeca, which was a tremendous honor. We are now rolling it out in communities. Our focus is really on community screenings. Eventually, we will have a distributor and a platform where folks can see them. But for the time being, we're rolling it out. Actually, in the US, we're rolling it out on a mobile screening truck, creating outdoor theaters. And we did that at Tribeca at the South Street Seaport in Manhattan. It was beautiful, followed by discussions of the films. The films are really meant to be starter pieces for a larger discussion of these issues. And so we're going on a little tour of the US and as well in some countries in Europe in the fall. All of this is on our Instagram and the various on the website and so on. And it's exciting to be able to engage with communities in person again, although we're also, I should say, planning various virtual screenings as well. And it's exciting to be able to use these films really as a mechanism for change, aside from changing public opinion and shifting ideas in the general discourse. We're also creating policymaker-focused screenings, funder-focused screenings. So really being able to use the films to achieve the ends of our partners and to support the work of our partners. The films very much are centered in the work of our partners. And they're deliberately so, because we are cheerleaders for the work that they do. And as I was saying earlier, it becomes very hard to talk about reform or abolition or any of these things when you can't see what it looks like. And so the films are an attempt to show people what good work looks like and what change can look like.
Sounds terrific.
And I should say to anyone listening, if anyone wants to do a screening or, you know, learn more about the docuseries, I'm happy for them to contact me and we can talk about that, especially in prisons. We're doing a couple of prison screenings as well.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I'm sure someone would love to take you up on that. I've seen pictures of your screen. It's a huge thing on the side of a van. Massively impressive. How did you manage to... You must have amazing fundraisers to get all this stuff together. How did you do it?
I wish. We don't operate on a massive budget. It's more that I have amazing partners who think creatively. The truck, which we rent, we don't own that truck. I'd love to own it. You know, was the idea of my collaborator on our various creative partners. And to me, that's also the beauty. Our chief collaborator on that project doesn't come from the world of prison reform. She comes from the art world. And so she's naturally going to think about these things in a way that's different from the way that I wouldn't have thought of the truck. So to her goes all of the credit, and actually becomes a very affordable way of both kind of staging a public intervention, because we park the truck in public places. And while it's not, when it's not playing the videos or the episodes, it's actually scrolling pieces of our art installation made from writing by people in prison around the world, which is called The Writing on the Wall. So it manages to do all of these things at once. It's not just a screening or a mobile movie theater. It's also a standing art installation and a kind of public intervention at the same time. And again, all credit to folks who think about public art, because that's what they bring to the table in this work.
Hmm. Fantastic. So finally, this is a bit of a two-parter, really, Baz. So you describe yourself as insatiably curious. Where do you get this attitude from, do you think? And secondly, what is it that helps you sustain your own well-being? Because you're spending a lot of time in really painful situations and tragic parts of the world. How do you look after yourself?
Well, As for the curiosity, I think to a great extent I was, you know, I'm a believer in dispositions, and I think I was just born with this kind of a disposition. A lot of energy, a lot of questions, a lot of kind of impatience with the world as it is, when it should be otherwise, impatience with things that don't make sense, and a hunger to know more. And I think I was blessed to grow up in a home where that was encouraged and not suppressed. My mother was a teacher, and I was a voracious reader and writer, and she nurtured that. And my father, who's a psychologist and worked in the prison system, worked in the court system at a county clinic in Mount Vernon, New York, was also someone who encouraged questions. And I say that the biggest blessing of how I was raised is that we didn't talk about the weather at the dinner table. We talked about real things, and it was loud, and there was yelling and all of that, which was sometimes unpleasant, but fundamentally we were talking about real things. And so all of that way that I think I kind of came out the womb was nourished and nurtured. And thankfully I found an outlet for it, because otherwise I think I'd be a pretty miserable human being, which brings me to the second part of your question, how I maintain kind of self-care or, you know, wellness. So music is huge for me. Music, specifically Caribbean music and Caribbean everything. I have adopted family there. It's a huge part of my life, as is South Africa now. I went there to work in prison, fell in love with the country and all of its complexities, and then ended up buying a place there and spending chunks of time there. And so I think nourishing the places that I love and the places that connect to my spirit, particularly because, you know, they're soaked in the kind of art and beauty that I love, whether it's natural beauty or music. I often say that to me, the counterpoint to prison is carnival. I have been a carnival regular for many years now, particularly in Trinidad, a country that I love a lot. And that is the purest celebration of joy, I think, that there is, and the purest embracing of life that there is. And prison is an attempt at, you know, creating living death. And so the counterpoint to that is to embrace life as much as possible in those settings. So I think that's my wellness plan in a nutshell.
Thank you very much. Well, I love these conversations that we have, particularly when I come out of them feeling invigorated. And there is something about your enthusiasm and curiosity which communicates itself directly to other people. So thanks very much indeed for that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I can only echo that, really. I think quite often so these conversations can go one way or the other, and we can end up feeling a little bit despondent about the state of things. So even though we're talking about something that really does feel quite tragic, it's really nice to have a conversation that shed some light on things being able to be, some positive action being taken. So thank you very much for coming along today and giving us this positive lift.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me and for doing what you do as well.
Thank you. Well, it was such an amazing conversation, and I feel so delighted that we got to the point of being able to interview Baz, because I read her book last year and found it so inspiring that when we started talking about doing a podcast, she was like the person that I most aspired to be able to interview, and really didn't think we'd have a chance of getting her on. So it was so delighted that we've managed to have this really upbeat conversation which describes so much positive action that's been taken.
Yeah, I agree. A very warm person, and her book, as you're suggesting, is so well written. It stands alone as a work of literature, really, packed full of information and memorable sentences and phrases. So I haven't completed it yet, so I've got more to look forward to. But also, well, as she says, she is such a dynamic person that I think she's created a lot of ideas and future leads for us to take up as well.
Absolutely. And I think what really came across through the interview was her passion for life and people. So people that often get written off by society, you can really sense her her love and passion to create something that's better for everybody in society, not just people that are more easy to kind of warm to.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.